Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine. The articles we read from the archive edition of the March 1992 issue were really interesting last week, so I'm going to continue with this same issue today. David Finfrock, Practicing Medicine on the Plains. Without the few pioneer doctors who settled in the early western towns, life on the frontier would have been even more precarious than it was. Injury from violence or accident and illness were the silent companions of everyone who ventured west. Shootings, knifings, frostbite, ranching accidents, timbering accidents, all took a regular toll. Railroads, such as the Union Pacific in Wyoming, were a major cause of serious injury. Railroaders often were crushed between cars, caught between trains and snow sheds, thrown from the tops of moving trains, scalded by exploding locomotive boilers, or injured in the frequent collisions and derailments. Time after time, communities were caught in the grip of major epidemics of smallpox, scarlet fever, typhoid fever, cholera, or diphtheria, all of which exacted a heavy toll, particularly among the weak, the elderly, and the children. In 1880, all of Wyoming territory had only 30 physicians and surgeons. Of those, some had little or no formal training, since there were no licensing laws to set standards. Others were heavily addicted to drugs or alcohol and were probably more of a hazard to their patients than a help. Some who were qualified sought more lucrative or less demanding professions. Dr. J.H. Hayford founded and edited the Laramie Daily Sentinel, and Dr. Hiram Latham turned to writing glib propaganda for the Union Pacific Lands sales promotions. One of the pioneer physicians who began his medical practice in the frontier west was Dr. John H. Finfrock. He arrived with the Army during the Civil War, when what was to become Wyoming was still a part of Utah, Dakota, and Nebraska territories. He continued to practice in the area for 30 years. He not only was an outstanding physician and surgeon who provided his patients with excellent medical care, but he played an active and important part in the civic and cultural life of the region as well. John H. Finfrock was born December 9, 1836, in Columbiana, Ohio, to an upper-middle-class family that included doctors, lawyers, and merchants. He attended the Columbiana Public Schools, Richmond College of Ohio, and the University of Michigan. He studied medicine with two uncles, Dr. William Blecker and Dr. A. Blecker, and in 1861, he graduated from Cincinnati Medical Hospital with the highest honors. Right after graduating, Finfrock listed in the Union Army as a hospital steward. Almost immediately, he was commissioned a captain in command of Company F, 64th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, part of General Philip Sheridan's division in the Department of the Cumberland. After fighting in the Battle of Murfreesboro in late December 1862 and early January 1863, Finfrock was advised by the Surgeon General of Ohio to resign his commission because of recurring ill health. On June 22, 1862, he had married Anna Catherine McCullough in Mansfield, Ohio. He and his bride now went to Cincinnati, where he took another course in medicine, starting in March and ending in May 1863. His health restored, and desiring a return to the Army, Finfrock took his medical examination boards in Columbus, Ohio, in early July, and was commissioned a captain, first assistant surgeon, on July 20, 1863. He was assigned to Colonel William O. Collins' 11th Ohio Volunteer Cavalry, one battalion of which was at Camp Denison, Ohio, ready to leave for the West, where it would join the balance of the regiment in protecting the stations along the Oregon and Overland trails. On October 19, 1863, Captain Finfrock reported as surgeon at Fort Halleck on the Overland Trail in the shadow of Elk Mountain. In the summer of 1862, Increasing Indian troubles had caused the Overland stage line to move from the route up the North Platte, the Sweetwater, and across South Pass to a more southerly route by the way of Julesburg, Denver, the Laramie Plains, and Bridger Pass. A telegraph line was built along the new trail, and freight and immigrant traffic also moved to this route. Fort Halleck was established on July 20, 1862, under Major John O. Farrell, 11th Ohio Cavalry, to protect the stage and telegraph lines. The change in route did not solve the problem. While the Sioux and Cheyenne harassed the northern route, the Utes kept the southern road under almost constant attack. Besides his duties caring for the sick and wounded of the 11th Ohio, the post surgeon cared for the immigrants, civilian scouts, freighters, and local residents. He was also responsible for recording the number of immigrants, wagons, and livestock passing the post, and for consolidating small parties into groups big enough to protect themselves. He served as post meteorologist as well. Frostbite and frozen limbs were major problems at Fort Halleck. Both men and animals suffered from the brutal cold. Finfrock recorded the loss of 4 horses and 3 mules over freezing and hard driving on the trip from Fort Laramie to Fort Halleck. In late December 1863 and early January 1864, he recorded temperatures of 30 and 35 degrees below zero. Scurvy was also prevalent. In April, Private Andrew J. Ralston died of it, and many other troopers were seriously ill. As soon as wild onions made their first appearance, Finfrock added them to the soldiers' diet. The commissary officer and an escort were also sent to Denver to try to get fresh vegetables. Besides his military duties, Finfrock made house calls. On April 27th, he left for Big Laramie Station, 66 miles east, to treat a stage company employee named Thompson who had been wounded in an Indian raid. Along the way, he extracted an immigrant's tooth for $1, prescribed an immigrant's wife for $10, took care of a man with erysipelas at Rock Creek, treated 2 sick immigrants and the child of the station keeper at Rock Creek, for which he collected $20, and treated a man for a sore foot at the Little Laramie Station. He arrived back at Fort Halleck on May 1st. On June 17th, Dr. Finfrock went to Julesburg by way of Fort Laramie to escort Anna Catherine, who was joining him at Fort Halleck. In July, he and Dr. Force repaired the dislocated shoulder of a stage driver using chloroform for the anesthetic. In August, he lost one immigrant whose chest was crushed in a runaway. Another with a wagon train 60 miles from Fort Halleck accidentally shot himself when he dropped his rifle during an Indian scare. The bullet tore through his arm from the elbow to the shoulder, and the wound bled profusely. A volunteer rode to Fort Halleck, got an ambulance, and returned to the train. Dr. Finfrock amputated the arm as soon as the patient arrived at the post. Still, the man died an hour after the operation. The same month, Finfrock also lost a premature baby. The following month, though, he delivered 2 healthy babies. In spite of Indian threats, the area along the trail was becoming more settled. In October, he treated a boy living on one of the new ranches near the Platte River for a mule kick that left a hole about the size of a $0.50 in his forehead. Finfrock enlarged the hole and elevated the bone away from the brain. Finfrock's prognosis was pessimistic, but the boy recovered. Sporadically through the summer of 1864, Indians attacked along the entire trail, and Dr. Finfrock had difficulty getting ambulances to evacuate the wounded to Fort Laramie. On September 25th, a brutal killing occurred at the post. A black civilian servant named Asa was accused of raping a 12-year-old white girl. The troops of D Company lynched him. He was tarred, feathered, set on fire, and finally skinned alive by Ed Lewis, the hospital steward, who then nailed the skin to the side of the hospital. Dr. Finfrock recorded in his diary that he dissected the body. A second lynching took place May 21, 1865. On May 13th at Cooper's Creek Station, Bob Jennings killed Hod Russell, a resident of Fort Halleck. Jennings wounded another man by the name of Olds. Soldiers from the fort were afraid to try and arrest Jennings, since Jennings was on friendly terms with the local Indians. The post commander hired a party of Indians whom Jennings knew to accompany Hunter William Comstock. Disguised as an Indian himself, Comstock finally arrested Jennings. Fort Halleck used a device similar to a well sweep to keep its meat supply safe from predators. The weighted end was so heavy, it took two or three men to raise it. A noose was placed around Jennings' neck, and the other end of the rope tied to the end of the sweep. Asked if he had any final words, he said he was going to hell, a whoopin' and hurrah for Jeff Davis and the Southern Confederacy. When the men holding down the sweep let go, Jennings' body shot up in the air the length of the rope, breaking his neck. When the only witnesses to Russell's murder, Mr. and Mrs. Dwight Fisk, arrived from Cooper's Creek Station, the executed Jennings was tried and found guilty. On October 16, 1865, Finfrock's first child, William Edmund, was born at Fort Halleck. 3 weeks later, Anna and the baby returned to Mansfield, Ohio. The first leg of the adventurous journey with a military escort to Denver. From Denver to Fort Leavenworth was by stagecoach, then on to Mansfield by train. Fort Halleck was abandoned July 4, 1866, and its garrison was moved to Fort Sanders, just south of the future site of Laramie, Wyoming. Dr. Finfrock continued to serve as post surgeon at Fort Sanders until the Union Pacific Railroad arrived in 1868. He resigned from the Army, entered private practice in Laramie, and served as surgeon for the railroad. The first railroad hospital in Laramie, under Drs. Finfrock and Gregory, was a tent on 2nd Street, conveniently located in the middle of the saloons, gambling dens, and dance halls. In 1869, a permanent hospital was built in the railroad yards. In 1870, the railroad closed the hospital, and Dr. Finfrock undertook its operation as a private enterprise. In a notice in the Laramie Daily Sentinel, he stated that he would also attend all calls between Cheyenne and Green River from railroad employees or citizens. In January 1871, Dr. Finfrock performed an amputation on a man whose leg had been badly injured 9 months previously when he was run over by a train. He used an advanced technique known as disarticulation. It involved separating the leg at the joint rather than sawing off the bone, then tying off the nerves and blood vessels. In 1876, the hospital was taken over by the Sisters of Charity. Shortly after the sisters took over, they and Dr. Finfrock had to deal with a major disaster. In 1874, the Union Pacific had opened a steel rolling mill in Laramie. It employed between 150 and 200 men per shift. On March 24, 1876, a boiler at the mill exploded, killing 4 men outright, hospitalizing 9 with serious burns, and injuring several others less seriously. Despite the efforts of Dr. Finfrock and the nursing sisters, 7 of the 9 hospitalized died. The same year, a serious epidemic broke out in Laramie, causing a major disagreement between Dr. Finfrock and the other doctors in town. It was the community's first outbreak of smallpox. Except for Dr. Finfrock, all the doctors initially diagnosed the problem as scarlet fever. Smallpox required that the town authorities establish a pest house and isolate all those taken ill. The city fathers wanted to avoid that expense, and the other doctors did not want to face the problem of isolating their patients. The post surgeon at Fort Sanders complained about the civil authorities' lack of control, and an order forbade soldiers from going to town during the epidemic. Finfrock's diagnosis was correct, and his early proper treatment saved many of his patients' lives. The Laramie Daily Sentinel of July 17, 1876, carried a thank you card to the doctor from his patients. When Dr. Finfrock finally got city authorities to open a pest house, it was located a mile east of town. When the pest house was ready, Finfrock went to the livery stable for a team and wagon to move his patients. No livery stable would rent him a team and wagon. On his way past the railroad station, he noticed a perfectly good push cart belonging to the Union Pacific. He got the loan of it and one at a time loaded his patients on it and pushed them out to the pest house. When he was through, he went to thank the agent and return the cart. The frightened agent told him in no uncertain terms to get out and take the cart with him. In 1883, the Sisters of Charity opened St. Joseph's Hospital, a modern 50-bed facility with two surgeries, one of which was especially equipped for amputations. It was staffed by five professional nursing sisters. The hospital drew patients from all over the territory. Dr. Finfrock repeated the disarticulation operation on a Mr. Stammy of Fort Fetterman. Another surgeon had amputated Stammy's leg 5 inches below the knee after his horse fell with him. The stump did not heal and was very painful. When Dr. Finfrock opened the stump, he found a piece of dead bone, a bundle of silk lying loose in the stump, and a ligature tied around the main nerve. He cleaned up the debris and completed the operation. 3 days later, assisted by four other surgeons, he successfully completed a radical mastectomy on a Mrs. P.A. Steinhoff, removing a cancerous tumor weighing over 3 pounds. Mr. Steinhoff fully recovered. Besides his surgical skills, Dr. Finfrock was also a vocal agitator for community sanitation. In 1876, the Union Pacific completed a water main from Springs east of Laramie to its rolling mills and repair shops. Dr. Finfrock worked diligently for the formation of water companies to complete branch mains down the side streets of the town so that a supply of pure water would be available for each household. He also pressed for the completion of a central sewer system throughout the town so that privies and cesspools could be replaced. He kept steady pressure on the city fathers to use prisoners to round up the pigs that rooted through the garbage and trash around town, to clean up the streets, water ditches, and alleys. He was a vocal and strong advocate of vaccination for smallpox and inoculation for diphtheria, particularly for the town's children. Dr. Finfrock found it necessary to dispense drugs from the time he first entered private practice. In the early 1870s, he opened a drugstore with a man named Toubreau, who was a trained chemist and pharmacist. In 1883, Toubreau went to New Mexico for 2 years, and Finfrock closed the store. When Toubreau came back to Laramie in 1865, they opened the Eagle Pharmacy. In early 1886, they built a new two-story brick building to house the pharmacy and Dr. Finfrock's offices. The second floor was fitted out as a photographic studio. The Laramie Daily Sentinel described it as a credit to its owners and another large stone in the edifice of Laramie's prosperity. John Finfrock's contributions to the community and the territory were not limited to his medical skills. He also had a strong sense of civic and social duty. Despite a pressing professional schedule, at various times, he filled many public offices. He was appointed Albany County Treasurer and Probate Judge when the county was still part of Dakota Territory. He was a member of the first Laramie City Council, a member and president of the Albany County School Board, County Superintendent of Schools, Territorial Penitentiary Commissioner, President of the Commission and Prison Surgeon, Mayor of Laramie, member and chairman of the Board of County Commissioners, and member and president of the First Board of Regents of the University of Wyoming. In his role as president of the University Board of Regents, Dr. Finfrock worked successfully to have the university designated as the Territorial Land Grant School, thus getting federal funding assistance that still continues. Besides his civic activities, he played an active role in his community's cultural and religious life. He was one of the founders of the Laramie Presbyterian Church and served on the Board of Trustees from 1869 until 1890. He served as president, treasurer, and librarian of the Wyoming Literary and Library Association, one of the first libraries organized in the territory. In its initial years, the library's books were kept in Dr. Finfrock's office. He was an avid gardener and is credited with introducing roses and lilacs to Laramie. The Laramie Daily Sentinel for July 12, 1873, carried a story on the fine strawberries he raised. And in a September issue of that same year, the editor commented on the splendid tomatoes the doctor brought to the newspaper office from his garden. When time permitted, he fished with his sons in the nearby streams and took hunting trips with his friends. Dr. Finfrock was also noted for his sense of humor. One of his sons inherited his vivid dark red hair. One day when the boy appeared at the barber's shop for a haircut, he was carrying a spool of thread in his hand. When the barber asked him what it was for, the boy said that his father told him to tell the barber to be sure to tie each hair before he cut it so that he would not bleed to death. After a less than successful hunting trip, he was quoted in the newspaper as having suggested to the rest of the hunting party that they put up signs in the area where they had been shooting so that no prospectors would mistake it for a potential lead mine. Besides their son, William Edmund, born at Fort Halleck, the Finfrocks had three other children. Their second child, Henry, was born in 1871, died at the age of 18. Their only daughter, Mary Catherine, was born in January 1873 and died in September of that year. Their last child was Albert, born in 1875. Mrs. Finfrock died in 1887 at the age of 49 after a long illness. In 1893, Dr. Finfrock's health began to fail, and he decided to move to a lower altitude. After a refresher course in surgery at Polyclinic Hospital in New York City, he moved to Boise, Idaho. 6 weeks after his arrival in Boise, on November 11, 1893, he was found dead in his bed in the hotel where he was living. The news of his death brought deep grief to the citizens of Laramie. His body was returned to Laramie for burial beside Anna Catherine and his two children. Despite bitter cold weather, his funeral was described as the largest in the city's history. The Laramie Weekly Sentinel closed its obituary of the doctor with a quotation from Shakespeare's Hamlet, in which Hamlet speaks of his late father. "He was a man, take him for all in all. We shall not look upon his like again." True West, March 1992 edition. "What Long Shot at Adobe Walls," by Leon Day. The white men had guns of all kinds, the Indians going back the same direction they came. Quite a number were assembled on a little knoll some 1,400 yards distance, thinking themselves safe. These hunters with their sharp shooting rifles did their best to dislodge these Indians. Finally, one fell. About dawn, Saturday, June 27, 1874, 200 to 1,000 Kiowa, Cheyenne, Comanche, and Arapaho warriors, their actual strength is uncertain, attacked 28 men and one woman in a buffalo hunter's camp at Adobe Walls, 3 miles north of the Canadian River in the Texas Panhandle. The fight produced a famous fest of marksmanship when Billy Dixon reportedly shot an Indian at a distance of nearly a mile. But Dixon's long shot was not as long as legend and professional historians have maintained. Quanah Parker, aided by medicine man Ishtai, led the Indian force. Ishtai had seen in visions how warriors should paint themselves to ward off white men's bullets. However, when the Indians made their first attack, the hunters mounted a successful defense, convincing the warriors that Ishtai's magic was a fraud. The Indians lost from 30 to 115 dead. Again, estimates vary. The hunters only 3. The Indians did not press their attack the next day. They were worried about the failure of Ishtai's medicine and had evidence that the whites perhaps had some magic of their own. About 2 p.m. on the first day of the fight, a slug hit Parker a glancing blow in the back. While the shot may have been the result of poor Indian marksmanship, it caused some to believe the whites had magic bullets that could circle a target and hit it from the rear. Later, a bullet killed Ishtai's war pony on the reverse slope of a ridge where the Indians thought they were safe. Of course, there was no magic involved. While no one was trying to hit Ishtai's horse, many of the hunters were firing at targets on the ridge. Their early centerfire cartridges, which had high arc trajectories and were deadly, but not accurate, up to 2,400 yards, would certainly endanger anyone on the reverse side of the slope. Any slug that just cleared the chest would give efficient grazing fire all the way down the opposite side. 40 years later, World War I machine gunners learned to do this on purpose to hinder supply lines from thousands of yards away. At Adobe Walls, the hunters achieved the same effect by accident. The defenders at Adobe Walls thought no range too great. The closest bluff to the camp was 700 yards. As the hunters were used to shooting single buffalo at 500 to 600 yards, they did not consider a group target in which any hit would be satisfactory, at 700 yards, a waste of time. Most of the men at Adobe Walls were Civil War veterans and all had great confidence in their weapons and marksmanship. Billy Dixon recounted the second day's fighting. "We saw only one bunch of Indians. They were on a bluff across the valley east of us. Some of our men opened up on them at long range. The Indians returned the fire and disappeared. It was plain to them that there was still a lot of fight left in us." Buffalo hunter Willis Skelton Glenn offered an account of perhaps the same event, writing, "The white men had guns of all kinds. The Indians going back the same direction they came. Quite a number were assembled on a little knoll, some 1,400 yards distance, thinking themselves safe. These hunters with their sharpshooting rifles did their best to dislodge these Indians. Finally, one fell, and the rest ran away, much surprised at such a long-range shot. Each of the hunters claimed the shot, and it was hard to tell who had done the work. They argued for a day or so when some of the bolder men decided to go back to the hill and examine the Indian, and they found him shot in the back. As they could not see the edges of the lead, one of them said, 'We will see who hit him,' and out with his knife and took out the bone of the ball was in and returned to camp. And it was proved to be the new Sharps 45 that had been sent there for trial. We now come to the long shot, which has become a permanent part of the folklore of the Adobe Walls fight." This is Billy Dixon's story from the second edition of his biography, Life of Billy Dixon, printed in 1927. On the third day, a party of about 15 Indians appeared on the edge of the bluff east of Adobe Walls Creek, and some of the boys suggested that I try the big 50 on them. The distance was not far from 7/8 of a mile, emphasis added. A number of exaggerated accounts have been written about this incident. "I took careful aim and pulled the trigger. We saw an Indian fall from his horse. The others dashed out of sight behind a clump of timber. A few moments later, two Indians ran quickly on foot to where the dead Indian lay, seized his body, and scurried for cover. They had risked their lives, as we had frequently observed, to rescue a comrade who might not be only wounded, but dead. I was admittedly a good marksman, yet this was what might be called a scratch shot." This account is almost evasively modest, except for the emphasized part. The editor of the 1927 edition of Dixon's book changed that sentence. The original 1914 printing, published the year after Dixon's death, claimed the range of Dixon's long shot was only 1,200 yards. Dixon had every opportunity to personally check the range of the shot, for after he left buffalo hunting and finished a distinguished spell as a United States Army scout, he returned to the area and homesteaded 1.5 miles south of the battle site. He lived there for 20 years and for most of that time was postmaster, commuting daily to the post office at the Turkey Track Ranch, north of the Adobe Walls ruins. Even if he never bothered to measure the distance, he knew the first surveyors to map the area and only had to ask them. This should make Dixon the expert witness to his own claim, but instead, most modern historians cite the figure from the second edition of Dixon's book with the same reverent awe with which the Comanches remember the death of Ishtai's horse. Indeed, most books give the range for Dixon's long shot as an incredibly precise 1,538 yards, 2 yards short of 7/8 of a mile, which would make you think the hunters rushed out immediately and marked the spot where the Indian fell. Careful study of a map of the area reveals the origin of the figure. If you swing an arc at a distance of 1,538 yards from the Adobe Walls Historical Monument, it passes through the horizontal station mark that surveyors used to map the entire valley. The figure that describes the position of the historical marker has been passed off as the range of Dixon's long shot. The range became exaggerated in 1924 as the result of the historical marker's dedication, which Dixon's widow, Olive, and the Panhandle Plains Historical Society planned for the fight's 50th anniversary. 3 weeks before the event, a reporter from the Amarillo Daily News and a surveyor visited the battle site. They took a copy of Life of Billy Dixon, which had a photo of a bluff with a caption claiming it as the spot where Dixon dropped the Indian. It is important to note that Dixon never said this was the bluff where the Indian was hit, only that he had seen Indians deploying in front of it on the first day of the fight. Editors captioned the picture of the bluff after Dixon's death. The surveyor quickly found the near end of the bluff was only 700 yards from the ruins and the far and only 1,028 yards distance. The Amarillo Daily News casually mentioned the bluff's far end as the place where Dixon's Indian fell. But careful map reading shows that the near end of the bluff, which was 88 feet higher than Adobe Walls, would have hidden anyone on the far end. Suddenly, Dixon's long shot was in jeopardy. Politicians, hoping the battle site would draw tourist trade, pressed for a resolution to the matter, and 1,538 yards, the distance from the historical station marker to the new historical marker, became the official range of Dixon's feet. The 1927 edition of Life of Billy Dixon echoed that change. Features on the ground agree with both Willis Glenn's and Dixon's stories. A small bluff rises 1,200 yards from the camp, and another begins about 200 yards farther on, almost directly behind the first. In the tumult surrounding the historical marker dedication ceremony, no one looked for these bluffs. They simply picked a range that exaggerated Dixon's claim for their own benefit. The confusion over the long shot prompted T. Lindsey Baker in Adobe Walls, History and Archaeology to question whether the shot ever happened. The problem with such skepticism is that Indian battle veterans remembered the shot very well. They may not have remembered the location accurately, but they leave little doubt that it occurred. In fact, two long shots might have been fired. In Glenn's account of the second day, so many hunters are shooting so many different kinds of weapons so fast that no one knows who scored a hit. They try to settle the matter with a field autopsy on the third day. In Dixon's account, he fires one shot on the third day at a lesser range with a 50-90 sharps, not the sharps 45 that Glenn credits with the kill. And the Indians recover the body. The accounts differ enough, possibly to refer to two separate incidents, with Glenn's more memorable to some because of the controversy, and Dixon's to others because he drew blood with one shot. Published ballistic data support both stories. In 1873, the United States Army introduced its new round for the trapdoor Springfield rifle, the 4570-405. This load had the same point form as all its military and civilian contemporaries, had the same initial velocity, and lost that speed at just about the same rate. The ballistic coefficient of the bullet was slightly better than the 50-90-473 Sharps that Dixon used, and slightly worse than the 45-75-420 Sharps that Glenn refers to in his account. Accuracy data on this load out to 1,100 yards were gathered from the actual firings at the National Armory. The figures, including an aiming error that can't be avoided with iron sights, increase at a uniform rate from 500 to 1,100 yards. Simple extrapolation can show what the group size for an effective shot will be at any range up to 1,600 yards. The hunter's weapons were likely to have been somewhat better than those used at the National Armory, as they had better barrel weights and trigger pulls. But both military and civilian rounds at the time were on the edge of contemporary technology. Commercial outfits like Sharps and Remington tested their new rounds with target shooters and buffalo hunters, usually coming to the same conclusions as the Army. At 1,500 yards, all shots will fall inside a 13-foot circle, and about half will be within 4 feet of its center. Assuming an unconcealed man exposes about 8 square feet of target area, one might think the odds of hitting a single warrior were something better than 1 in 16, and maybe closer to 1 in 10, supposing the marksman had perfectly estimated range and wind. But the pattern made on a vertical target doesn't tell the whole story, for other Army data show that at 1,500 yards, the bullet falls so steeply that the total danger space is less than 4 yards. Thus, a bullet might hit a single man, but only by inhumanely accurate estimation of the range or some lucky combination of errors. Now, Dixon's shot can be clearly evaluated. The range to the top of the bluff he mentions is 1,250 yards. Here, the group size would be 10 feet and the danger space 12 yards. Dixon was shooting at a group target wider and deeper than that. His chances of hitting something useful to the enemy, be it man or horse, were excellent. What he considered a scratch shot was really a smart shot. The 50th anniversary of the battle at Adobe Walls was a grand Texas party with barbecue and speeches that drew about 2,000 citizens who were not too picky about what Billy Dixon did or what claims were put in his mouth. In 1929, Dixon was reburied at Adobe Walls, as history by then considered his long shot there to be his major triumph. His fight at Buffalo Wallow, also in 1874, earned him a Congressional Medal of Honor, but had receded to footnote status. In 1941, the Indians put a marker to their own dead, and the site now stirs images of the brave men on both sides of the fight. As Quanah Parker put it, they killed us in sight and out of sight. True West, March 1992 edition. Witness to a Hanging by Oscar W. Williams. Edited by Robert J. Torres. Editor's note. Public hangings probably were among the most popular and well-attended events in the American West. Thousands of people witnessed these frequently ghastly events, yet surprisingly few wrote personal accounts. One of the most fascinating of the few accounts which have survived is by Oscar W. Williams, who recalled the March 14, 1881 hanging of Richard Ramin at the southwest New Mexico mining town of Silver City. Williams's letter, written to a relative in China in 1925, contrasts sharply with the cold and impersonal facts normally found in official documents and newspaper reports of the time. Despite having been written nearly half a century after Williams witnessed the event, the letter is nonetheless an incredibly accurate document. When compared to the documentary record, a few errors are evident, mostly regarding proper names and other minor details. None of the errors detracts from an extraordinary description of a fairly common, but rarely so intimately described, occurrence in frontier New Mexico. we know little about Oscar W. Williams except for his involvement in a series of civil suits over ownership of mining claims in Grant County. The dates of the suits verify he was in Silver City at the time of Ramin's execution. His letter is courtesy of the Silver City Museum, Silver City, New Mexico. Fort Stockton, Texas, January 25th, 1925. Mr. J.C. Williams, care of Texas Company, Hankow, China. My dear J.C., once and only once have I seen a man pay the extreme penalty of the law for his crime. It was not an experience which a normal man would desire to witness, but the story of his crime and its punishment will develop some peculiar incidents and will serve to illustrate the temper of the people in those frontier days and the conditions under which the law was administered better than any other way in my power. So I have decided to write it to you. I believe my memory can be depended upon as to all the facts which came within my personal knowledge, but I cannot be so assured as to the facts which came to me from the lips of others. But such as I will set out on information were believed by me at the time to be proven, although as the story goes back some 45 years, you can readily understand the chances of error. In the spring of 1881, I spent some days in Silver City, New Mexico, at what was then known as the Timmer Hotel. There was a stone copping in front of the hotel, marking the division between the sidewalk and the street, and it was the custom of the guests and town idlers after meals to sit out with feet elevated on this copping to discuss such news and gossip as might be current in the town. While so engaged, one evening after supper, I saw a man with a basket on his arm pass through a gate leading to the kitchen from the enclosure at the back of the hotel. I had seen this man at other times pass through this gate with a basket on his arm, and always he was alone. I asked my companions about his name and purpose. I was told that his name was Ramin, and that he was carrying food to the prisoners in the jail some four blocks distant. Oh, I said, a deputy sheriff or a jailer. No, they said, he was a prisoner under sentence of death. Now, it was almost dark at the time. The hotel building was at the foot of a hill at the extreme edge of the town's buildings. There was a rocky canyon a few yards south where the hiding was good, and apparently the chance of escape for the prisoner was excellent. So it was with a good share of astonishment that I set out to learn the man's story. This is what I was told. Ramin and a man named Winterburn from Albany, New York, occupied a room in a building in the little burg of Central City, a few miles distant from Silver City. They cooked their food in their room and slept in a double bed. Winterburn seldom indulged in drink, but Ramin drank to excess, and when intoxicated was a quarrelsome, evil-tempered man. One night late, on coming to the room, much the worse for drink, he found Winterburn lying across the bed asleep in a position which interfered with Ramin's attempt to lie down. Angered, he procured an axe, killed the sleeping man at a single blow, and in a tempest of rage continued to hack and beat the dead body until it was cut to pieces. After this fury had been spent, the drunken man dropped asleep and was found later on the same bed with the victim. He was immediately arrested. Afterward, he was tried for murder in Silver City, which was then the seat of Grant County. His brothers, back in Tennessee, were poor men, but they helped him with such money as they could scrape together, and an attorney was employed to defend him. Ordinarily, this would have almost ensured his final release in a community so engrossed in the pursuit of the get-rich-quick plans of the time as to be almost indifferent to any crime that did not in some way directly take a dollar away from the citizen. To exert himself to bring a criminal to justice was to take time and energy from the hunt for a mine and to expose his life to danger from the criminal's resentment, While there was no disposition on the part of any other citizen to aid or even to sympathize with him. The doctrine of laissez-faire was carried out to a high degree on these frontier mining camps, except in the matter of adopting camp rules to protect the locations of mining claims in a new camp. But there were notable exceptions to this rule, and the brutality of the murder brought public attention to the deed in a very unusual degree. Then, too, the sheriff, Whitehill, was at that time trying to make a good record in his office, and Winterburn's brother back in New York, having hired an attorney to prosecute, put up money to assist in procuring and holding for trial the witnesses necessary for conviction. So the stars went out of their usual courses to fight against Ramin. In spite of his attorney and of the delays in coming to trial, which were considered by the lawyers to be a defendant's best defense, and in spite of the subsistence of feeling against him, Ramin, on trial, was found guilty and sentenced to be hung. His attorney appealed the case, but Ramin was not allowed to give bail and was kept in the Silver City jail while his appeal took its leisurely course through the higher court at Santa Fe. When we set out by the stone coping discussing the case, it had been some months after the appeal had been taken, and any day might bring word over the military telegraph line that stretched from Santa Fe to Silver City that the prisoner must be hanged. The best that Ramin could hope was a reversal and an order for a new trial. Yet the sheriff appeared to be giving him every chance for escape that he reasonably could. It was stated that he was allowed to go out at nights to gamble in the town, and having stayed out until 11 o'clock one night, he was sternly notified by the sheriff that this could not be allowed, as it made too much trouble to the jailer to let him in after bedtime, and that thereafter, if he did not come back by 10 o'clock, he would be damn sure locked out. It was not understood why the prisoner had failed to make his escape under these circumstances, but it was believed that he was relying on his attorney's opinion that the case would surely be reversed. And in the meantime, life was easy and the fare of the Timmer Hotel was good. About a week later, I was told that the sheriff had received a telegram from Santa Fe stating that the upper court had approved the action of the lower court, and that the prisoner should be hung on the following Friday. So when Ramin came in that evening from gambling, he was locked in to await the day set for execution. The sheriff invited me to become one of the legal witnesses provided to attend the execution and to vouch for the due carrying out of the sentence. Being possessed at the time with an itching curiosity to see how death would be met by a man who flagrantly neglected his chances to escape from it, I accepted the invitation. That curiosity passed with Ramin's death. I never had it to return. The decree of the court was executed within the palisaded enclosure around the jail and in the presence of about 20 men. The scaffold consisted of a platform of planks elevated about 5 or 6 feet above the ground and large enough for the free movements of 5 or 6 men. There were steps on the north side to mount by, but nothing further was attached to the frame save the simple skeleton of the gallows on the eastern margin of the platform. Here, there was a sliding platform of small size projecting out from the main platform between 2 upright timbers, which supported on a crosspiece at the top the rope for execution. This slide could be suddenly pulled back under the main platform by means of a trigger set under the platform. We had ample time to examine the machinery by which the drop was worked before the time set for the execution. While waiting the hour, the sheriff told me that the prisoner had smoked up a half box of cigars and consumed 5 or 6 bottles of wine during the past 24 hours and had expressed his determination to meet his fate quietly and without complaint. After learning that everything was in readiness at the gallows and that the man of God was present in sight of the prisoner's refusal to call for his presence, Sheriff Whitehill went into the jail to bring out the condemned man. He was inside for quite a few minutes, but during that period of waiting, it was noticeable that the hum of conversation died down to a few whispers among the bystanders. Death was near. At last, the jail door opened, and the sheriff stepped out, holding in his hand a box of cigars. Behind him came the prisoner. Of rather small size and insignificant presence, with a face covered by a ragged dark brown beard, and clothed in ill-fitting garments, he presented a picture which one would have passed on the street without consideration as a poor specimen of physical humanity and probably of little moral significance. But standing in the shadow of death, he was invested with a strange dignity. With carefully balanced and slow steps, he came out with a lusterless eyes, blinking in the bright sunshine, giving an impression of one whose mind was little concerned with what was before him. The sheriff afterwards attributed this appearance to a measure of stupor brought on by the cigars and wine he had used up during the previous hours. To my mind, there was something more in it than mere smoke and drink. After a few words with the sheriff, which I did not hear, he slowly ascended the steps, assisted by the officer, and here he turned to gaze over the upturned faces, possibly hoping to meet a friendly glance. If he saw such a face, he gave no sign of response. He refused some request of the clergyman with a mute shake of his head, and turning to the officer, made a request which the officer seemed to grant. He then turned to his audience and began a slow, halting address, which became more animated as he proceeded. It was a declaration of innocence, an assertion of perjury on the part of the prosecuting witnesses, and a charge of prejudice against the trial judge. It was a rambling and disconnected, and there was so much repetition in it that it caused us to think that he was talking on to save a few wretched minutes of life. He left no message to friend or kin, no warning to young or old, and no word of hope in God or man. He was not checked or interrupted, but finally ended his talk with some inarticulate cadence deep down in the throat, as if the voice were dying before the body passed out. The preacher knelt down and prayed. If the prisoner heard a word of the prayer, there was no sign of it in the stooped shoulders or in the faded eyes. When the prayer ended, the deputy sheriff stepped forward and, with the aid of the sheriff, moved the man over so that he finally stood on the slide between the two upright posts and under the noosed rope. Then the prisoner's ankles were bound together and his hands were tied behind his back. Then the noose was let down and fastened around his throat, and after that, the black cap was placed on his head and drawn over his eyes. As the last move before the end, the knot of the noose was turned so that it rested just under the ear of the doomed man. The deputy stepped back and looked to the sheriff, which gave a mute signal, and we heard the sound of the trigger as it was unlocked. The sliding platform slipped from under the feet of the dying man, and his body shot down between the uprights and stopped with a thud that caused the beating of my heart to cease for a moment. I heard the sound of indrawn breath coming from the spectators as if their hearts, too, had halted life for a second. The bound legs of the prisoner were drawn up convulsively and pressed against his breast for a few moments, with a curious quivering movement, as if shaken by the passing of the soul of the dead man. Then, with a slow, gradual decline, they lowered until the limp body hung straight down from the knotted rope. The sheriff looked at his watch, turned to the jail, and went inside to make his report to the court that at a certain hour, on a certain day, in obedience to the mandate of the court, he had caused the defendant Ramin to be hanged by the neck until he was dead, all in the presence of the following named witnesses, citizens of New Mexico. I went away feeling that there was something in the story of the last days of Ramin that had not come to me. Here was a man threatened with death, with the gates of safety in sight, yet who apparently had made no effort to pass through the portals. Around the town lie a wild world, a world of wooded hills and rocky canyons, and with a few small mining camps scattered about in lonely places. But the Indian and the mountain lion marauded the very borders of the parade ground and the solitary fort that have guarded the foothills. It would have been an easy matter for Ramin to have escaped into these hills. There, hunger or the Indians might get him. But the sheriff, never. That chance was at least worth taking. So I made some effort to find this fugitive element in the Ramin story. And finally, I caught the trail and followed it down. I was reminded of it in that part of The Palaver of the Fortune Teller, who examines the palms of hands and tells you that a certain line in your hand, which crosses another certain line at a certain place, is the line of Mars crossing the line of Venus, and means that at a particular time you will meet the lady you will marry. In Ramin's case, it meant that in jail, under sentence, he was to meet a woman of sinister history, whose fascination led him to neglect his last chance of safety. The woman was said to have come from California several years earlier and bore a rather doubtful reputation. She must have had some personal attractions, considerable shrewdness, and a devilish disposition, judged in the light of her career about Silver City. She succeeded in getting a respectable man named Granger to make her his wife. He was a man past middle life, having a weak-minded son, and was believed to have some money with him and some property back in Illinois. He owned a mining project which he thought valuable and had begun sinking a deep shaft on it with the aid of the sun and of a man who was known as Silver Plate Dick, because he was continually asserted that he had a silver plate in his skull to cover a flat fracture. After his death, it was found that he had no such plate, and it confirmed the general impression that he, too, was mentally defective. Now, the woman planned to kill her husband, so she gradually acquired a hold on Silver Plate Dick, and even on the son, until she made them confederates in the plan. The two men killed the old man at the shaft, threw his body in, and filled the shaft up with rocks and earth taken from it, just as the woman planned. She outlined the story that was to explain Granger's disappearance, but the weak-minded Confederates could not sustain the story, as could the woman. In the end, they confessed. When they came to their trials at Silver Plate, Dick was tried first, and after conviction, was hung. Next, the boy was tried and received some 15 years in the penitentiary. When Ramin went to jail, the woman was an inmate awaiting trial, and after his death, she was removed to Mesilla, and being tried there before a Mexican jury, received a sentence of only 2 or 3 years. Now, the apartments for men and women in the Silver City jail were considerably apart, but there was a corridor in which both sexes walked for air, sunshine, and exercise, separated only by an iron railing the length of the corridor. Here, Ramin and the woman plotted and jested, swore and cried with each other through the iron bars as each told a tale of trouble and revenge, until Ramin became another victim of the woman's evil life. When the line of his life crossed the line of Granger's murderers, it meant that the days of his life were to be cut off. He could not leave the woman, or would not do so, while the road to safety yet lay open. To him, the world was lost for a woman. Possibly he thought it was well lost, but there was nothing in his dying talk to indicate such a belief.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.